I'm coming into this discussion of decolonial critical thinking as a black African woman born in a formerly colonized country. It was called Rhodesia, but when it was under the British Empire, and then I was born the same year that the liberation movement to fight for independence started, and Zimbabwe became independent when I was 14 years old. So I kind of grew up during that time. And when the war was happening, I grew up going to those vigil nights with liberation fighters at night, and then during the day, soldiers are coming. So I'm a child of the war, I grew up in that space. Because of that, I'm critical in the way I think, even though I'm coming from a Eurocentric, because in Zimbabwe we learn from, we use English, our curriculum is British, everything, we are British actually. But when we go home, we also encounter orature. We learn from orature, from our grandmothers, from the stories that we are told. So in the process, I am in between the two kinds of knowledges. That helps in the way I think and the way I see things. And I'm also speaking here in Finland. I'm having moved from Zimbabwe, a country that has been going through a crisis, economic and political crisis, and which is caused by many factors, but mainly the colonial legacy and that we took back our land. And when we took back our land, we did the president during that time, Mugabe, we said we would take back our land by force, because when we became independent, the British were supposed to pay for land that would be bought from the settlers so that the African people could be given land. But they negotiated in bad faith such that they eventually reneged on the agreement. And when they reneged on the agreement, the freedom fighters who fought for war, they were specifically fighting for nothing else but the land, that land. So there was a serious crisis, and eventually there was the decision to take land by force, and they're using the laws the same way they came and took the land without paying, but they used the law, so that's what they did. But then we went under sanctions, and those sanctions have crumbled the economy. We are in a perpetual economic crisis. So because of that, there is a lot of movement, not because people want to move, but because of the situation, the global, the geopolitical global power that is not equal, and the distribution of wealth is not equal, and because of that, we cannot rebuild this economy. We have been in an economic and social political crisis for more than 20 years now. And when things are like that, people start moving, the educated. And I moved to South Africa, and then eventually I moved here because of family. So I am also speaking here as an immigrant living in Finland, who is also in a Finnish university, and who is encountering also the power dynamics in those institutions. So this is the story that I am coming with, and that is the story that I encounter this child, this child called Frida, that you saw in the video. I'm not going to go much into it. I think most of you followed the discussions when we were going. But when I see Frida, I don't see her as material like what Plan International and all the other were seeing. I see her as a human, because I'm coming from a consciousness that this is a girl just like me, 12 years, and maybe she has become pregnant, but she's still human. So I'm encountering her like that. And I'm also aware of the power dynamics that are playing out on Frida's body. And I'm also aware of the need, yes, of fundraising, but how do we fundraise? So as I discuss this, this is a paper that I'm still working on. I look at I use this, the concept of representation that she, Stuart Hall and others talk about. They say from postcolonial perspective, Stuart Hall examines how images, works of art, language, discourse function as systems of representation and produce certain ways of knowing self and others and how one relates with them. So images are not just innocent images. They are communicating and there's formal and informal learning that is happening there, and they also inform the way people see others. So from people seeing this child, they also see many black people through the eyes of this child. So it's not one person, it's representing a community of people. But while she's representing a community of people, it means we are all interested in what is happening to her, those who see her as human. We are interested in what is happening to her. I had encounters with this image, like what was said in the video. And after that, I went to sociological research research conference, and I presented a paper there. After presenting a paper, I commented also on what was happening in that video. And after that, I was told that the following day, I was told that the campaign that you were commenting about, they've been given some prizes. They've won prizes. So I was surprised that they had won some prizes. And then I said to this person who was telling me, can I see? And then I saw the image of this girl in the amphitheater that they used. She was there, the big picture of her in the center, and there were many people in this amphitheater. So when I looked at it, what came into my mind was, why were all these people not seeing that this is not okay? What does it say about Finnish people? They don't see that there's something wrong with this whole thing. From the campaign itself, and from even sitting in this auditorium, having this picture of this child, big picture in the middle. It was actually in the middle of that theater. So this encounter with this, and I call it a colonial exhibition. Why do I call it a colonial exhibition? I call it a colonial exhibition because there is a history of this happening. I think I will give you an example of this Rosa Klei. I hope you have heard about it, but maybe you have not heard about it. Rosa Klei was a South African, black South African woman who was taken from South Africa by the British, and then they brought her to Britain, and then she was exhibited because of her body. She was exhibited in many places as making money using her body. Europe has actually that history of eroticizing women. From UK, she was moved to France, and then eventually she died. But she was an important figure. Her actual name was Sarah Bartman, but she was called Hottentot Venus. As a name for using her, but she had her name. In other words, they unnamed her. And when she died, they put her in a museum in France, and she became also an object of study. But the fascination continued. It was about her body. And then in Finland, we have Rosa Klei. Here I have her image here. We have Rosa Klei, who was also brought to Finland by missionaries from Namibia, and displayed in on markets, churches, and so forth to raise money for missionary work. So I think what we can say is that we have different kinds of women here. I just give these two examples, but there are many examples of women. But what I want to show is that Freda's case is not a special case. It is building on what is continues to happen, that black women are taken and then they are used as objects to raise money or for for different fantasies. So what I can say now here is that Frida follows the case or the path of her African ancestors as she has been exhibited in the streets and bus stops of Finland from that period. And I think what I can say is, when I'm still on that, the use of these girls, I can also connect this with the Nena Paiva. Nena Paiva, I think it was last year, they also had their own fundraising, and they used this child. This one is from Tanzania. So I think many of you saw this child on the machines. When I went to get money myself, I was just trying to get money, then the child popped, then I tried, and you could not go anywhere until you say you agree or disagree to pay money. Then you pray yes, you press yes, then you pay in the money, and then you can withdraw whatever you want. But if you don't, then you say no. So I encountered this child as well. This child is from Tanzania. And Nana Paiva, they said that he is from a community that they serve. So I think we can see this this use of children, and you can see his face and the way he's represented. And when I had a meeting with all, the one thing that came out from all the meetings I had is that they consider them as material. They would say the material is from. So they would not see it's material in the sense of you are using, but this is a child who can come up one day here. Because even the way the way he's looking, he's a healthy child. If you look at it from Africa, he's a healthy child. But if you don't know, then you think that because the use is that he is, actually the campaign was about disease and diarrhea and so forth to raise money for diarrhea. So he was representing diseased child. So I think it also taps into that. Stereotype of black children as diseased, having diseases. So when we had this meeting, I said there's nothing wrong with this child. I grew up like this, and we enjoyed it. And when I carried this, exactly the jug, the way he's carrying, and I brought water and I gave my mother, and the way she smiles, I still remember that was the most pleasing thing for me. I didn't feel abused. I didn't feel, because it was a normal life, so you can not use it like this and say the child is being abused or is diseased and all that. And even the skin can be dark, it doesn't mean it's diseased. That's the color of the skin. So I think we can see a pattern that is emerging of using black children. And there's another one I did not put. I think two. I talked to them, but those ones quickly removed them. They were also fundraising. There's another video that has been going on. I think last month that the child with tattered clothes. It was going a lot on Facebook and Instagram. You'd see it from another organization, Save the Children, I think. What is the problematic for me as a black woman is the representation of this child and the image that this child creates. So because of that, we were not happy, and we did some campaigns. Because of that, we were not happy, and we did a campaign to counter that. We did the campaign after hearing about the crisis. We tried to do campaign before. Then quickly it ended. Then when we heard that the prices, then we sort of thought that now this is really sustaining this narrative and actually is a way of doing things. Then we did a campaign. We did a campaign because of all these different prices that they had been given. So we thought that now we have to make them aware that this is not a good thing. So we did a campaign and we had meetings with all these organizations. So while these organizations were very proud and happy. We had, even when we had meetings with them, they were proud, but eventually they understood what was wrong with it. But we emphasized to them that if for black Africans and people of color, this campaign was not successful, it had failed. It had failed in ways that a white person living under the protection of global white supremacy and white privilege will never know nor fully understand, because race continues to function in painful ways for us, black and brown people. This pain that was caused by this campaign in the Afrofin, African, and African diaspora and people of color communities is the pain of systemic and institutional racism that we continue to encounter. So the question is, why would you feel pain? Because we are dressing the child in nice clothes and so forth. I think we explained that to them that we are feeling pain because if we use Edward Said's concept of exotic subject, we were feeling pain because we felt that Frida had been used as an oriental object and had been used as an exotic object. She had been eroticized, she had been sexualized. I think Paula talks about it as well in her video. I think what we realized when we were doing this, talking with these people, is that there's a different understanding of who is considered to be a child. Because why did these black children lose the right to be children, to be protected, to even not have their names put or even their faces put or their, or even where they came from? Everything was so open, even when you went to talk to them. So why did these children lose this right to protection? I think what emerges there is that because we are coming from cultures that still value indigenous knowledges, we are coming from a background. For example, Linda Tui-Hiwai Smith's indigenous knowledge, decolonizing methodologies, research, and indigenous peoples draws on this tradition, but she draws from Maori traditions. She advocates for this indigenous methodology because it has survived colonialism. It has survived the backlash. And it is useful because it challenges some of the Eurocentric knowledge system, and it can be used for resistance, and the return to indigenous knowledge is important. So we saw that we're coming from a culture that saw this child in a different way. We saw this child from a way of, in African culture, we have what we call collective motherhood. We have this wisdom saying that we say it takes a village to raise a child. So if it says it takes a village to raise a child, in other words, a child is raised by everybody. Not one person can raise a child, because you are not where the child is every day. And when this child is moving from one place to the other, it can be supported by different people. So it takes a village to raise a child. So I'm calling this collective motherhood. It was a method that I used also in the campaign when I was doing this campaign. Collective motherhood in the sense that anyone could just join the campaign. You don't have to be invited, because it's a collective motherhood, or collective parenthood, or collective sisterhood, or collective brotherhood. So you just see this and you feel for it and you join, and we use the petition online that many people signed, and then that petition we submitted it. We submitted it to plan, and then it helped pushed them to apologize. But first they apologized for white superiority complex, and then we continued to push, and then eventually there was an apology for doing this. Nena Paiva also apologized, and there was a lot of learning that happened. We saw that they looked for people who could help them to understand about using these images. Okay, so I think what I can emphasize here is that the story of Sarah Batman, the story of Rosa Clay, the story of Frida. They show something about how, especially the photographer and the designer and the whole team, there were women there, saw how they see black women and black children. I'm looking for the correct words to say it, that there is this way of, I think what comes out from this, from our video here, this way of white savior complex, that he kind of represented black women as failed mothers, and that kind of represented the child, the girl child as one needing to be rescued by white women. There is also this white gaze that comes out. There is this, what we can, one might say, racism. There's also loss of childhood status. There's also objectification. There's sexualizing. There's eroticizing. There's colonial prejudices. There's a treatment of the children as uncivilized and coming from a culture that is not civilized. So I think it is an important factor that, especially white feminists, those who might need to consider how they see black women and how they see black children, and how if helping is good, but how do you help, but without dehumanizing, without taking away the humanity of those people that you are helping. Also, realizing that poverty does not mean that you lose your human status. You are still human even if you are poor. You can be helped, but in a way that is respectful. Yeah, so I think what the question that I can say, that I can ask, is it okay for white women to build careers on black women's bodies? Because I think that's what images, Chandra Mohanty talks about it in Under Western Eyes. Maria Lugon talks about it in this decolonial feminism. It's emerging a lot, that this idea of building careers on black women's bodies. And I think we can see that it's happening here, especially with these celebrity designers and celebrity photographers. But the question is, so what can we do? So are you saying we should not help? No, we are. I think we are not saying you cannot help. We are saying we have to, there's need to know that institutional racism is not sustained without individual racism. If the moment people start to be racist to children, then racist to the mothers, racist to the fathers, racist to then it also participates in sustaining the system. Because if we really want to dismantle the institutional racism, I think we have to be able to live together without practicing it, and then we can have more ability to strategize and destabilize the institutional racism. But I would like to say, even though these other women did this, the campaign was supported by many white women. Many white women, white feminists supported the campaign. So it's not like it's racial, but it's about understanding, I think, like what she was saying, unlearning, learning to unlearn, and then learning new things. We had many, 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 even when we went for demonstrating, we had white women who came to demonstrate with us. So it's not about white women and what, but it's I think we can say it's a certain kind of liberal feminism, what I call latte feminism, those rich people who sit in nice places and decide to help without really even understanding how the things are working. But us as Pan-Africans we say an alternative narrative is possible. We can create a new narrative, and to create this new narrative, there is need to decolonize the mind. And how do we decolonize the mind? It means we have to really work on really work reading so that we can start to unlearn some of the things that we have learned, because most of these things are normal. Because why did they get a lot of money like this? They got a lot of money because for many people it was normal. Why did they get prizes? They got prizes because for many people it was normal. But eventually, even them, they were embarrassed. They deleted everything after really understanding what they were doing. So it means we all have to go through some process of learning, all of us, because this white patriarchal knowledge, we have all consumed it, and we have been feasting over it over a long period of time. So it means we have to detox ourselves. How do we detox ourselves? By doing the work. The work is uncomfortable, but uncomfortable as it is, I think uncomfortability is the starting point to unlearn. Because feeling uncomfortable, it means we are realizing that there's something wrong. So if we are realizing that there's something wrong, then it means that's a starting process of working on how we can change. And how we can challenge the systems institutional racism, institutional white supremacy. We can challenge it by understanding. Because if we don't understand, how do we do it? It's not an easy work. Sometimes it's not even safe to do it. But I think we are where we are because there are many people who opened the doors for us. So if there are people who opened the doors for us who started most of this work, we can just join it and continue. I think where we are is bad as it might look, but there's a lot of progress. There's a backlash at the moment, but the backlash shows that there is progress. If there's a backlash, it means there is progress. So, but if there's progress and then now there's backlash, how do we recover and reflect on how the ways we have been doing things, and where do we need to improve, and where do we need to change in order to regroup and work harder? Because what is happening in the air now, I think we can see changes. There's a lot of change, which is not good, which is also like in taking us back. Yeah, so I think what I can say is that we need to work, and we need to when we see what is wrong, we need to stand and change. Change will not happen on its own. We have to work for that change to happen.